It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As strange as this story may seem, this is a work of nonfiction with no invented dialogue. Every reenactment you hear comes from government files, archives, diaries, letters, newspaper articles, books, or trial testimony. It's an autumn night in 1920. George Remus and his driver haul a truckload of whiskey from Kentucky to Cincinnati over the Cincinnati-Covington Bridge. It's a routine trip, one they'd made many times before. But on this night, a car traveling from the opposite direction veers in front of their truck and blocks the road. Remus's heart pounds. Whiskey pirates. A roving band of thieves intent on stealing all his liquor. His driver flees on foot, leaving Remus to fend for himself. The pirates surround Remus's truck and point four Tommy guns at his head.
Stick 'em up high.
Remus stands his ground.
Pull your triggers. Shoot, you cowards. And if you do, you'll never live to tell the tale.
The men attack. The smack of flesh against flesh. The crack of ribs. A hard bash against Remus's head. Blood drips into his eyes. Remus knocks out three of the thieves, but the fourth climbs into Remus's truck and speeds away, taking hundreds of cases of whiskey with him. The next week, Remus tracked down the boss of the pirates, who surprised him with a compliment.
You have more guts than 20 men and deserve to keep your liquor.
Remus just laughed and hired a few of the ringleader's men to drive his trucks. Insurance against future attacks. If you can't beat them, buy them. It was the Remus way. I'm Abbott Kaler, and this is Remus, the Mad Bootleg King. From the minute George and Imogene Remus arrived in Cincinnati, they hustled to get Remus's circle operation spinning. Remus promised Imogene that she would be his partner in everything. She would oversee business records and plans he couldn't share with anyone else. There was nobody in the world he trusted so fully. Now, both his livelihood and his heart rested in her lovely and clever hands. Together, they ruthlessly exploited the loophole Remus had found in the Volstead Act. Their first purchase was a downtown drugstore. With some legal trickery, they turned it into a wholesale drug company that could pull permits from the federal government to sell, quote, medicinal alcohol. They quickly bought several more drug wholesalers in Cincinnati, across the river in Kentucky, and in New York City. From there, they shifted to the supply side of their bootlegging venture. Remus bought the H.E. Pogue Distillery in Maysville, Kentucky, 60 miles from Cincinnati. He entered negotiations to buy other distilleries that had stockpiles of liquor made before Prohibition. Next, he hired a team. A few discreet inquiries led him to local Prohibition officers open to bribes. Once he found his marks, he hired confidential men to bait them into accepting payoffs. He recruited a traffic man to handle his 147-truck fleet. He brought in secretaries to falsify paperwork. Imogene's brother came on as their, quote, all-around man. And of course, they needed a personal chauffeur and a personal cook. High society demanded nothing less. But the most important hire was a man named George Connors. Connors, the son of poor Irish immigrants and a lifelong resident of Cincinnati, was a powerful real estate broker with useful political connections. Connors was Remus's physical and psychological opposite. With a wiry, compact build and a reserved demeanor, Connors' quiet, steadfast nature complemented the extravagant, bombastic Remus. Remus believed he would make a fearless and savvy lieutenant. He would become the bootlegger's most important mediator, not just in business matters, but in personal dealings too. The battle with the whiskey pirates exposed Remus. He needed a safer, more secluded storage facility. A headquarters where whiskey could be housed and where trucks rolling in and out would not arouse suspicion or risk being hijacked by competitors or seized by police. It didn't take Connors long to find a spot in the woods outside the city. Connors and Remus went to check the place out. They drove northwest toward the small town of Cheviot, 10 miles outside Cincinnati. They turned down Lick Run Road, a long, twisty passage devoid of any other traffic. The farther they drove, the more the road narrowed. Hundreds of pear trees formed a canopy of leaves above them. The road looked like it would dead-end into a forest. But instead, a two-story clapboard farmhouse came into view. Close by were three barns and a scattering of outbuildings. A man in his mid-50s, heavy and unshaven, stood amid the buildings to greet Connors and Remus. His name was George Dater, and he owned the place. He told them Prohibition had wiped out his own business, a small grape-growing and winemaking operation. Dater wanted to rent out the farm for storage privileges, and he figured a bootlegger like Remus would be an ideal tenant. Remus offered $100 per week, and the deal was done. Remus and Connors returned the next day with a truckload of whiskey and began unloading cases, 250 in all. But Dater began to have second thoughts. He was putting people in danger. He could not afford to be arrested, and neither could his hired hand, who lived on the property with his family. Dater took his concern to Connors. It did not go well.
We're gonna get pinched.
Get out of the way and shut up.
Having put Dater in his place, Connors and Remus continued their work until the whiskey truck was empty. Connors and his crew began turning Dater's farm into an impregnable fortress. A company of marksmen stood guard at all hours. They were armed to the teeth. Shotguns, pistols, automatic rifles, and ready to protect the stash. More armed guards manned the hayloft in the barn. An electric buzzer connected them to the second floor of the house, where another guard kept watch during the night. Guards at the entrance instructed approved customers to drive into the yard and dim their headlights three times in quick succession. At this signal, the men in the barn pressed the buzzer, and guards in the house illuminated the entire yard with a high-powered floodlight. The compound soon earned the moniker Death Valley Farm, both a warning to trespassers and a hint at the fate of those who tried but were never seen again. The rumrunners would take Remus's liquor and sell it to speakeasies back in their hometowns. During my research, I discovered an original 1925 menu for a Chicago speakeasy.
What's the password?
The moon is shining bright.
One could get a champagne cocktail for 75 cents. Other cocktails had unique names, Dirty Dick's Flip, Maiden's Prayer, and my personal favorite, the Corpse Reviver, a hangover cure that remains popular today. Made with gin, Lillet Blanc, orange liqueur, and lemon juice, the Corpse Reviver came with a warning. Four of these taken in swift succession will unrevive the corpse again. To keep the Circle's runners loyal, Remus treated them as though they were on vacation. They enjoyed a free car wash, home-cooked meals, and a soft cot to sleep on. Important runners could even play games of craps with money Remus gave them on credit. When they were ready to make a pickup or delivery, Remus personally handed them a sack of sandwiches, a thermos of milk or coffee, and a few quarts of whiskey. He explained that his runners should never have to drink their own supply on the road. And Remus's customers all knew they were getting the highest quality booze in the business.
Remus sold good liquor.
He disdained those who muddled clean, pure whiskey by cutting their supply with sugar or water or wood alcohol. Those inferior bootleggers didn't care if the customer went blind or paralyzed or died or lost his mind. Once Death Valley Farm was in place, Remus's circle never once stopped spinning. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, his trucks blackened the roads. Children playing along the route to Death Valley halted their games long enough to cry, "There go the whiskey trucks!" Remus took pride in his work. He was raking it in and doing good for his community. Prohibition cost thousands of jobs in liquor-related industries. Bartenders, waiters, truckers, barrel makers, and glass workers were all out of work. But Remus would rescue them. He welcomed 3,000 men to his payroll, becoming one of the largest employers in Cincinnati and a de facto hero, providing quality whiskey and the money to buy it. Just as he refined his business operations, Remus was refining his own persona. He added and subtracted traits and nuances, shading and sharpening his lines. He changed how he talked. He never used one word where a half dozen might do. Merely saying thank you wasn't enough. Instead, he would offer thanks
from the teeming fullness of my grateful heart.
He developed a meticulousness that bordered on phobia. He could not tolerate a speck of dirt or disarray. He couldn't abide anything that restricted his freedom in body or mind. Piece by piece, he replaced his wardrobe with bespoke suits made of silk. Smooth, baby-soft silk, he decided, was the only material that should touch his skin. Imogene Remus was remaking herself, too. Whenever she wasn't at Death Valley Farm, supervising orders or greeting clients, Remus encouraged her to go shopping for home decor. He wanted little trinkets and fixtures that would make the mansion they were renovating like none other in the city. She spent afternoons shopping for solid gold service plates and silver cutlery, which she had engraved with his initials, GR. She never looked at price tags and pulled out her checkbook for anything that caught her eye. After all, she had a $100,000 diamond blinking from her hand. Even young Ruth became known for her extravagant possessions. Bottles of Guerlain perfume, lavish outfits, and a genuine muskrat coat. She gave favorite classmates diamond-studded gold and platinum figurines that cost $15,000 apiece. Remus called her Princess. They would be the perfect family, happy, content, always there for one another. Or so Remus thought. And Remus's business was about to get even easier, at least for a while. In the spring of 1921, shortly after President Warren Harding's inauguration, Remus got a call from an old Chicago law colleague named Elijah Zolin. Someone in the Department of Justice, a close friend of Attorney General Harry Daugherty, had made it known that the government was willing, even eager, to conduct business with bootleggers. For a certain price, Remus could get an unlimited number of genuine permits to withdraw pre-prohibition booze from distilleries. Zolin told Remus he could arrange a meeting on neutral territory in New York City. Remus was definitely interested. Business was booming, but it grew riskier by the day. With each whiskey withdrawal, he took the chance that an honest prohibition director would discover his subordinates selling permits. To mitigate this issue, Remus bought a rubber-stamped copy of a local prohibition director's signature so he could forge the permits himself. But large-scale forgery also posed obvious risks. Buying authentic permits directly from the federal government, as Zolin was suggesting, would both streamline the process and diminish its dangers. Zolin made good on his promise. He took Remus to New York for a rendezvous in the lobby of the Commodore Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. Soon, Remus saw a man swing through the doors and approach them. He was an odd-looking character, wide and squat, with a florid complexion and a coarse, bristled mustache. Black wire glasses made imprints on his fleshy cheeks. Zolin made the introductions.
George Remus, Meet Jess Smith.
Zolene left the men alone to talk.
I hear you're a large operator in the whiskey industry. I could provide you with all the permits you need. For consideration, of course.
Smith told Remus that the permits would bear the authentic signatures of state prohibition officials who reported to the Justice Department. A bit of insurance if Remus encountered any suspicious authorities. Then came the quid pro quo.
So, Remus, what can I expect from you?
Remus thought it over.
Per permit, between $1.50 and $2.50, depending on the size of the shipment.
The next topic was an even bigger coup. Smith offered to use his political clout, in particular his relationship with Attorney General Harry Dougherty, to protect Remus from legal trouble. If Remus found himself prosecuted for bootlegging, Smith promised there would be no conviction. And if, for some reason, a conviction happened, Smith would arrange a pardon from Dougherty. For this service, Smith would accept $50,000. For starters. Without hesitation, Remus reached into his pocket and counted out 50 grand, all in $1,000 bills. The men shook hands and agreed to meet again soon. It was the first in a long series of meetings. Remus kept paying Jess Smith big money for his whiskey permits and legal protection, 30,000 bucks at a time, always in cash. With Smith's assurances, Remus operated openly, even brazenly. He milked distillery after distillery as fast as he could. He bought the Edgewood Distillery in Cincinnati and ordered his four-sib bottlers to get to work. Within 5 days, they removed 6,500 cases of Old Keller, 500 cases of Johnny Walker, and 250 cases of Gordon's Gin. The same drill was repeated in dozens of distilleries. Frequent and massive deliveries to Remus's Death Valley storage space filled the place to overflowing. Remus's chain of distilleries and drug companies stretched across 9 states, from New York to Kansas. His clients included the head of the Chicago mob, Johnny Torrio, and his ambitious protege, Al Capone. Remus and Connors had so much money they couldn't count it, and so much whiskey they couldn't store it. Connors spent hours counting cash. The money came in so fast that Remus couldn't deposit it all, forcing him to carry as much as 100,000 bucks in his pockets at any given time. He even considered opening his own bank. One broad estimate of Remus's net worth at this time was between $21 and $40 million, and that's in today's money. Remus had the Washington politicians in his pocket and an army of men moving his liquor. But he had no idea that a powerful woman was maneuvering to knock his playhouse down.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mabel Walker Willimbrandt was the Assistant Attorney General of the United States, the most highly ranked woman in American government. She was responsible for all prohibition-related matters in the country. It was her job to hunt down the top bootleggers and bring them to justice. Willimbrandt was, in her own way, a lot like George Remus. She had always felt destined for grand and public endeavors.
For all of my life, I have had the most uncanny feeling against which I have often struggled that seems to always say to me, you are marked to step into a crisis sometime as an instrument of God. It seems that it may mean danger or disgrace or in some way cause me agony of the heart, but I can't escape it.
Also like Remus, she rose from hardscrabble beginnings. Mabel Walker was born in a sod dugout on a remote Kansas plain in the waning decades of the American frontier. It was around the turn of the 20th century, and young women on the frontier were expected to have the same resourcefulness as men. And if they failed, they were punished as severely as the young men. Her parents, both descendants of German pioneers, worked tirelessly to shape her character. When she bit her pet cat's ear, her father bit hers. She developed a ruling philosophy to which she would adhere for the rest of her life.
Look above and beyond the immediate task.
At age 13, Mabel began formal schooling and cast her mind in all directions. By the time she began her own teaching career in her late teens, her resume claimed a nearly unfathomable range of expertise. In addition to the usual basic school curriculum, she also mastered botany, zoology, biology, physiology, freehand drawing, domestic science, household economy, clay modeling, and even gymnastics and baseball. She did not tolerate disrespect from her students. On one occasion, a boy attacked her with a knife. With one deft move, she snatched the weapon from his grasp and delivered what she called an enthusiastic licking. She had another favorite saying.
Life has few petted darlings.
And Willimbrandt certainly did not consider herself one of them. Every morning, she filled her bathtub with ice and forced herself to soak in it. She believed such daily discomforts built stamina and character. Willimbrandt knew what she wanted and wasted no time in pursuing it. She graduated from what is now Arizona State University and then moved to Los Angeles, enrolling in the University of Southern California's law school. She had a short-lived marriage, which she ended for a surprisingly progressive reason. Her husband wasn't pulling his own weight. Throughout their marriage, Mabel had nursed her husband, Arthur Willimbrandt, through tuberculosis, cared for his elderly mother, and worked full-time as a teacher to pay for both of their law degrees. Not to mention cooking, cleaning, and preparing the next day's lessons before attempting a few hours of sleep. When they separated, she lamented that only she had made the, quote, necessary adjustments of marriage.
A wife should be concerned with the preservation of her freedom, her self-respect, her intellectual and executive attainments, her economic independence, finding the best outlets for her energies, finding the best protection for her spirit, and establishing a basis of mutual understanding with her and her husband in order to have both a child and a job if she wants both.
After graduating from law school in 1916, Willimbrandt became Los Angeles's first female public defender. In that job, she argued 2,000 cases, focusing particularly on prostitution. She employed a rule that forced Johns to show up in court alongside the prostitutes they'd hired. She avoided sentimentality in favor of honest, pragmatic support. When one client, a madam, sought advice about going straight, Willimbrandt assessed the woman's finances. She determined that the madam could retire after 6 more months and even loaned her some money to help with her fresh start. The problem was, Mabel Willimbrandt did not have much to loan. 5 years as a public defender put precious little money into her bank account. But then she got a telegram that would change her life. Attorney General Harry Dougherty invited her to come to Washington to meet President Warren Harding. The new Republican administration was eager to curry favor with women who had just won the right to vote. They wanted Willimbrand to fill the position. She would be in charge of federal income taxes, prisons, and, most important, all issues relating to the Volstead Act. Willimbrand was so strapped for cash that she had to borrow money for train fare and a new blouse to wear for her interview. Unlike George Remus, Willimbrand liked to drink, especially California wine. She didn't believe in prohibition, but she would ruthlessly enforce it. Her new digs at the Justice Department were like nothing she'd ever imagined. In her office sat a gleaming mahogany desk the size of a barge. She had a personal staff of 6 people, 3 attorneys, 2 stenographers, and 1 secretary. They quickly nicknamed her the Queen. Her salary was $75,000 per year, almost $125,000 in today's money. But when she sussed out the politics of prohibition enforcement in the Harding administration, she got a surprise. None of her bosses, including President Harding himself, had much interest in waging the war on liquor. He even served liquor in the White House during card games with friends and appointees. It was easy to see why the administration had courted her for the job. She was just 32 years old, 5 years out of law school, and had never prosecuted a single case in her career. They knew she was inexperienced. They thought she would be intimidated and overwhelmed. And they assumed they would be free to continue their profitable relationships with bootleggers like George Remus, selling whiskey certificates and promises of protection. But to her boss's surprise and dismay, Willimbrand took her oath of office in the fall of 1921 and buckled down. Aside from crooked bosses, she faced other serious challenges on the job, rampant sexism, for one. Many Americans didn't like the fact that a woman held one of the most powerful jobs in the country, especially when she was enforcing a very unpopular law. Newspaper reporters couldn't write about her work without mentioning her appearance, the cut of her dress, the style of her hair, the height of her heels, the color of her eyes, whether she'd gained or lost weight. Even her hands were scrutinized. One article noted her low-set thumb and her middle finger of unusual prominence. Willimbrand hated this double standard and privately griped in a letter to her parents.
Why the devil do they have to put that girly-girly tea party description every time they tell anything a professional woman does?
And yet, she felt compelled to play along, trying, at least in public, to strike a balance, neither too masculine nor too feminine, too aggressive or too demure, too indifferent or too emotional, too much or too little of any quality that would highlight her sex instead of her work.
I try not to think of myself as a woman in going before a jury. By this, I do not mean that women should be mannish, but that they must forget about themselves.
Willimbrand also had to contend with a physical impairment. She was almost entirely deaf. She did not want her bosses, colleagues, or opposing counsel to know of her condition and spent an hour each morning fixing her hair to conceal her hearing aids. In Willimbrand's archives at the Library of Congress, I found dozens of letters she wrote to her parents about her hearing issues, letters expressing her sadness, frustration, and especially her rage.
The dread shadow of deafness all but submerges me. For, Mama and Papa dear, when from every quarter and indirectly I hear the most extravagant marvelings at my capacities over the way I handle myself before the court and when presiding over trying conferences, that surge of bitterness rises even in their praises when I think, damn you, you think that's good? Do you know what then I could do if I weren't struggling under the most horrible handicap that you do not guess?
Sometimes, in reading these letters, I noticed that Mabel had pressed her pencil with such force that the tip had broken off. Willimbrand didn't mind her immediate boss, Attorney General Harry Dougherty, but she had misgivings about his personal assistant, Jess Smith. Although his office at the Department of Justice was just down the hall from her own, she had no idea what Smith did all day. As far as Willimbrand could tell, Smith seemed to be an errand boy who bought railroad tickets for the Attorney General and carried his briefcase. Dougherty himself told Willimbrand, Oh, don't pay any attention to Jess. If I have any directions for you, I will give them to you. There's a telephone on my desk, and I will reach you. She would soon learn, however, that Jess Smith was aiding and abetting the biggest bootlegger in the country. Her first clue came in a telegram from an Ohio-based federal district attorney who described what he called an almost unbelievable condition in Cincinnati. Although his office had successfully prosecuted several prohibition cases, they were now facing, quote, one of such magnitude and so far-reaching that they needed Washington's help. A thorough investigation by capable agents could, quote, stamp out in this community the so-called whiskey ring. Willenbrandt opened a brown folder labeled Department of Justice, Mail and Files Division, and slipped the telegram inside. She would soon scrawl one word across the folder, underlined with a heavy hand. Remus.
On this date, November 20th, 1927, this session of the Criminal Division of Common Pleas Court in Hamilton County will come to order.
I call Emmett Kurgan to the stand. You talked to Mrs. Remus?
We were down to Ragland, Dixon, and Williams' office, and Mrs. Remus was sitting in the waiting room. And I came in, and she came over and shook hands with me. I met the lady once before. She said, I am afraid of this man. I am afraid he is going to kill me. He is so insanely jealous. If he walked in here now and seen me talking to you, he would be liable to shoot both of us.
Next time on Remus, the Mad Bootleg King.
We're prohibition officers. Hands behind your back.
I've got everyone and his brother in Washington on my payroll.
We know he's been working his influence all up and down the line. Congressmen and public officials in the state of Ohio, and clear up even to the White House itself.
Remus, the Mad Bootleg King, is a co-production of iHeart Podcasts and School of Humans. It's hosted by me, Abbott Kaler. Chuck Reese and I wrote the show. Our producer is Miranda Hawkins. Our senior producer is Jessica Metzger. Executive producers are Virginia Prescott, Brandon Barr, Elsie Crowley, and Jason English. Sound design and mix by Chris Childs. Elise McCoy composed original music. Additional scoring by Chris Childs. Voices in this episode provided by Ben Bolin, Lauren Vogelbaum, Julia Criscal, Noel Brown, Matt Frederick, James Morrison, Lou Carlozzo, Jonathan Sleep, Joel Ruiz, Jay Jones, and Van Gunter. Special thanks to John Higgins from Curiosity Stream and the team at CDM Studios in New York. If you're a fan of the podcast, please give it a review in your podcast app. You can also check out other Curiosity podcasts to learn about history, pop culture, true crime, and more.
School of Humans.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids.
Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.